Netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney, you're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Thanks for joining us for this week's FX Podcast. I'm Jeff Huser. Today's podcast, Mike Seymour is going to speak with Tim Baer about stereo photography. Stereo photography is a phenomenon that's growing more and more now that we have digital projection. You may be familiar with projects like Beowulf, U2 3D, Meet the Robinsons, Nightmare Before Christmas being re-released, James Cameron's Avatar being produced now, Hannah Montana, which made a lot of money, $31 million because of high ticker prices after costing $7 million to make a concert film. Anyway, if you start looking into 3D movies, you can see it's more than a fad. You'll see names like Cameron, Spielberg, Zemeckis, Lucas, and Katzenberg attached to projects involving stereo photography. In fact, Jeffrey Katzenberg says there'll be 12 to 18 full 3D movies by the year 2010. One of the reasons for this is, on the average, 3D movies produce three times the revenue per screen of traditional movies. So the studios are taking notice of this, as well as the theater owners. There's currently probably north of 1,000 movie theaters that are equipped for this technology, in the United States anyway, and they estimate in the next 3 years it could be as high as 10,000 additional theaters to that. So it's a phenomenon that's growing, and we're going to see more and more of it. Some, obviously, are going to be met with more success than others. But for us, it's the technology. And not only is this podcast an interview with Tim Baer about this technology, but it also marks a milestone in adding to our Art Of series. We've done such things as the Art Of HDR, the Art Of Keen. You'll find a lot of these if you go to the homepage on FX Guide and then hit Feature Stories link at the top, and then in the center you'll see FX Guide Recommends, and there'll be a list of our more highly rated stories, and you'll see a whole series of Art Of in there, and this one will join it. Anyway, let's move ahead to the interview with Mike and Tim.
Tim, thank you for joining us today.
Yeah, no worries, Mike. Pleased to be here.
So you're you used to be primarily a visual effects supervisor, but that all changed, what, about 3 years ago?
Yeah, about 3 years ago, I started sort of dreaming of a plan to head out bush and shoot some time-lapse footage. And at about the same time, it occurred to me that I could start experimenting with stereo photography by buying an extra camera. With my background in post-production, you know, I felt pretty confident I'd be able to tackle any obstacles that came along the way. So, yeah, some high-quality digital SLRs and started shooting time-lapse, built an intervalometer and bought a Moco pan tilt head and just got underway.
It doesn't really do your work justice, though, because for two levels, I guess. One, because it doesn't give any of the idea of the scope. I mean, some of the shots we saw earlier, you actually sort of climbed mountains with packs of tech gear on your back. And secondly, of course, the quality of the 3D, I have to say, is some of the best 3D, if not the best 3D, I've actually ever seen in terms of projected 3D from digital projectors. But let's start with the first one, which is lugging up mountains. In some cases, it really was a case of you being your own Sherpa, right?
Yeah, pretty much so. The short answer to that is it very much helps to be slightly obsessive compulsive. So, yeah, I mean, if you want to get a shot from a specific location, you have to get there. But being an entirely sort of self-funded and sort of alone out there, you also have to be very good at sort of managing your time, you know, and not slacking off, I guess.
And to get those shots that you couldn't get from climbing a mountain, by the way, one of which you said you had to climb three times, you also had an ultralight. Tell us about that.
Well, I've got a background in aviation. I've got a private pilot's license. If we go back a long way, I wanted to do a coastal flight around Australia, which is my home country, and you know, and record some of the scenes along the way. But after doing some of the math and figuring it out to hire an aircraft, which the owners would want back very quickly, it was smarter to buy an ultralight. And also, the type that I got is powered parachute. So I can fly very slow. It's very open cockpit. I can photograph in pretty much any direction I want. There's no windows in the way. It's very safe aircraft as well. So,
If the engine dies, you've already got the parachute open.
And I've done a skydiving course too. So you steer it with toggles, just like skydivers do, and flare just before you land. So
if we can paint the mental picture, you're over some of the most interesting and yet some of the most desolate areas of Australia. How high up?
Yeah, well, I can legally fly up to 5,000 feet. But more interestingly, unlike general aviation, where the lower limit is 500 feet, you're not allowed to fly below 500 feet for safety reasons. With this class of aircraft, the recreational regulations, all they require is property owner's permission, and you can fly as low as you like. So I could put like a beer bottle on the ground and fly as low and knock that over if I wanted to.
So you're up somewhere between beer bottle height and 5,000 feet, and you're wanting to get effectively, I'm going to call it for the rest of this podcast, 3D imagery, but what we mean is stereoscopic imagery. And you've got a stills camera. Now, what intrigued me was that you managed to pull that off in that instance, in certain occasions, with a single camera. Can you explain how that worked? Because I thought that was an ingenious solution.
Yeah, well, originally I started shooting aerial stuff with two cameras side by side as I shoot the stuff on the ground. Well, first of all, I wanted to experiment with the full spectrum of what we can do with stereo photography. In hypo stereo, which is macro photography, ortho stereo, which is where you want to create an accurate representation or sense of scale, and hypo stereo, where we move people's eyes effectively, you know, anything up to tens of meters apart. So for the aerial stuff, I originally started photographing with two cameras, but really I can put them up to a meter apart with some apparatus I've got, but from those long distances, if you're on a scenic flight, you don't see much parallax depth in the landscapes you're looking at. You see motion parallax because the speed of the aircraft, but really the distance between your eyes is nothing in comparison to, you know, something that's a kilometer away. So no parallax information. So as a creative exercise, I wanted to see, you know, what happens if we position people's eyes tens of meters apart. So I found it's actually better with static landscapes. It won't work on coastal stuff with rolling waves, but to use a single camera, point it 90 degrees to the track of the aircraft, so not the nose of the aircraft, because I might have a little bit of crosswind. So I look at the ground, look at which way the aircraft is actually flying, point the camera 90 degrees to that, and then take a sequence of photos, of which I'll only use two, and one for your left eye and one for your right.
Now, of course, we think of them normally being taken sort of split seconds apart, but these may be taken up to, you know, quite
maybe 5 seconds apart.
Yeah. Right. But in that 5 seconds, you've moved the equivalent of what would be meters if you had to have two cameras separated by some kind of apparatus.
Pretty much so. I'm flying generally around 40 kilometers an hour. And, so basically I can plug the GPS into the camera and record the latitude and longitude. Or the speed of the aircraft and the time interval between the photos will tell me the stereo base.
And as cool as that is, and hopefully we'll be able to stick up some photos showing you do that, the thing that really impressed me was just actually the quality of the final 3D imagery that we were looking at projected. And so let's get into that now, that sort of more geeky side of things, because obviously you have a very strong artistic background, but it is... first and foremost, judging these images has to have a huge technical component to get these looking. You had to have done a lot of research. I mean, how did you go about doing them?
Definitely a huge logistical challenge. Shooting 4.3K RAW files using Nikon D2X cameras. And so I spent probably about 4.5 months just getting the pipeline airborne for digital asset management. So that automates the process of ingesting shots. It's hooked into a MySQL database, and you can have multiple concurrent projects on it as well. And automatically assigns shot IDs and all that stuff, extracts the EXIF information for lenses that were used and exposure settings. I manually punch in the info about how far apart the cameras were, if there was any ND filters on the camera. It tallies all that up and gives you the light value. So basically you can get a good idea of how bright the scene was. So I can just access that info from the database if I want to. The slates are very important in terms of, you know, being able to, you know, I've got thousands of shots now that I've accumulated, time-lapse, stop motion and still photos. And I want to be able to sort of readily access those and refer to what sort of techniques I use to shoot them and what that means from, you know, the audience perspective in how they sense the scale.
And then in terms of just getting imagery that works for the viewer, there's a lot of science in actually being able to project images and even edit the images so that it doesn't cause the headache, nausea, or just general annoyance that we've seen going back a few years when there was a sort of a less precise science.
Yeah, that's something that we really want to pay a lot of attention to. Is stereo cinema has been tried a number of times in the past and failed. The reasons why is because it caused audience eye strain and headaches. The really significant thing that has happened now is digital cameras, digital post-production, and digital projection. So stereo imagery is a dream that goes back hundreds of years, you know, past Charles Wheatstone in 1838. Leonardo da Vinci wrote of, you know, the limitations he has in trying to paint a scene is it doesn't have depth and dimension that that we see with our two eyes. So, but now we have this technology, it's lots of electronics and bits and bytes, but the upshot of it is that we can craft images and have pixels land on a cinema screen with millimeter accuracy. And that means that we can, once we figure out the rules and the techniques for shooting and posting and projecting this stuff, we can completely avoid eye strain.
And it's your opinion that the current resurgence of 3D in cinema, in other words, the move to studios actually requiring more and more production and the ability to project that, is more than just another passing fad or in fact just a fashion thing that's going to go back out of fashion. You actually believe that there's a full sort of seismic shift going on, really, don't you?
Absolutely. If we look at the role and purpose of media and how it evolves, it's driven because its purpose is to complement our existing perceptions. So we can have a look at the transition from photography to, you know, motion picture cinematography and the introduction of movies, the introduction of sound, because, you know, we've got hearing, obviously, color, stereo sound, surround sound. And now finally that we've got the tools that we need, we can acknowledge that we are, in fact, born with two eyes.
I guess from my point of view, And I don't think now's the time. I think there is some really huge commercial debates and discussions, and certainly I'm keen to be educated on the viability. But I think one of the key aspects of the whole problem is the ability to do this at a dramatically reduced price point, and just for that matter reduced flexibility, because digital projectors, I mean, you're talking about, what, a couple of grand per digital projector, and you can get sensational images out of that.
Yeah, well, the projectors that I've been doing all my test screenings off, as we mentioned, I'm shooting 4.3K, I'm mastering 2K, and the projectors I use are 1280 by 720. So they're about 1K, so relatively low. But from a perceptual point of view, when your brain fuses the left and right images together, remember the technique I'm using is with two projectors pointed at the one screen with linear polarizer filters on it, so we get full color. I won't go near anaglyphic with a barge pole because it just compromises the imagery. But the point I'm making is with this setup is there's a perceptual sort of up-resing. So you actually perceive a slightly higher resolution than what the projectors actually
are. You certainly do. You can certainly perceive them as being very sharp. Now, in terms of the commercial systems that are at the cinemas, there's at least, what, three or four that are currently vying for installation and, you know, your general multiplex kind of non-special attraction ride 3D stuff?
Yeah, there's a few different systems, and I'm not fully across all of them. I have seen the Real D system, and I quite like that one. Dolby are also putting out a competing system that uses a different technique by splitting the frequencies of light, so basically sort of interleaving them like a comb, but I'll have to think about that bit more to better explain it.
And so what we've got is a technology that we can sensibly, as sort of an industry, look at installing at the cinema level. Is it going to be constrained, you think, to the cinemas? Is this really something that the cinemas want and that is going to bring people back to the theatres, or is it going to move from there out? I mean, how much of an advantage is this going to give in the medium term? I mean, obviously, in the short term, the cinemas are the only places that seem to have projectors and set up for stereo properly.
I think we're going to see it develop on a number of fronts. First of all, we'll just talk about the demand and whether people will actually enjoy it, which I think my mind is racing with ideas of creative possibilities, from action films to nature documentaries. You know, this sort of technology permits us to show people that, you know, they have just never seen before. But simultaneously, we're also going to see this evolving, I think, on the PC front with stereoscopic LCD screens. Now, I'm not talking about the auto stereo screens, because I don't like those. I don't think many people do, because you have to hold your head in a specific position to get the proper 3D effect. And then there's a bit of, you know, you see the barrier mesh and stuff on it. It's not full resolution. But using a technique of having alternating the polarization on adjacent pixels on a sufficiently high res screen is we'll be able to hit a button on our computers, flip from 2D mode to 3D, and pop on a pair of, you know, polarized glasses.
And to a certain extent, that market, the computer market, is a better market in one sense, because people, you know, tend to be replacing computers a lot. There's a perception that you're going to sit, you know, a certain kind of distance away from a computer screen. It's almost like a more controlled condition than just sort of domestic viewing on a TV set, for example.
Yeah, it's certainly screen size, or more specifically, the field of view of the screen, the horizontal field of view. For example, the setup I've been using to master my shots, I use 46 degrees, which seems fairly typical for your average cinema. IMAX, of course, would be a much higher sort of horizontal field of view than that. And it's horizontal we're concerned with, more so than vertical. But, yeah, so TVs obviously will vary quite a fair bit in the size that the final size that people end up seeing them at, you know, because the size of the screen varies and also the viewing distance. Whereas computers, people tend to sit, you know, a typical distance away from the screen. And another advantage I think we'll see from the stereo LCD screens, or whatever the technology ends up being, is that it's just more comfortable for your eyes to be converging on something, you know, 2 meters away than something much, much closer, like we typically view our computer screens. We sit close to our computer screens because, you know, we need to see the small fonts and stuff like that. But, you know, using the stereo screens, we'll be able to just push our desktop back a bit further so our eyes are converging at a more comfortable distance, and it'll just be a more pleasant experience from that point of view.
Now,
too,
for you personally, you obviously serious and great career in visual effects before you decided to sort of basically pause and explore this other work creatively as a filmmaker. Do you think you're going to take those 3D skills back to working in visual effects, or do you want to become more of an independent filmmaker, perhaps even a naturalist filmmaker?
I'm definitely interested in documentaries and in producing content to end up on screens. A lot of fascinating things in this world that I'd love to see myself on screen, and stereo is a fantastic opportunity for us to do that.
Do you think the VFX and the post community is well placed right now to pick up the slack in the demand that's seeming to come from the studios in wanting to really embrace 3D?
Well, pretty much, we've got all the technology. It's all fairly off the shelf stuff, but what it comes down to is having a very good mental model of what matters. You know, what does changing the distance between the cameras do? What does angling the cameras in do? What does cropping certain and panning sort of pictures, how that sort of influences the end result on screen? I think you can only gain that insight by experimenting, making mistakes, and figuring out what's the right way to do it.
Yeah, it's one example that you gave me, which I thought was particularly interesting, which was the idea that one of the reasons that people got sort of uncomfortable with 3D is that you are often requiring the eye to readjust at different distances effectively. And so as the cuts happen and the shots change dramatically with, say, more of what would you call an MTV cutting style, your eyes had to work much harder going in and out, and you used the analogy of looking at something like a bug on a windshield as opposed to looking way off in the distance when you're driving, and keep changing that constantly, it's going to give you a headache.
Yeah, so if we want to sort of empathize with what we might be putting the audience through is as you're driving your car, look off in the distance, then at a bug splat on your windscreen. Do that, say, 5 times in quick succession and you'll start feeling your eyes wear out pretty quickly.
So what this led to, which I thought was tremendously interesting from a editorial perspective, was actually effectively having almost dissolves, to want to use that analogy, at the end of each shot to kind of bridge into the incoming shot. Can you explain a little bit?
Yeah, well, the dissolves are actually... what we need to do, some of the most important metrics that I've found, the stereo metrics, is... the horizontal offset, which I'll call the horizontal disparity, screen disparity, of the furthest object in the scene and the nearest. So that's sort of how much you, if someone decides to look off in the distance, you know, how much are their eyes going to have to diverge? We certainly don't want it to go beyond a certain limit. If you imagine looking at a distant star, your eyes are pretty much parallel. In practice, we can push it maybe, I've found 3 degrees beyond parallel, is and people still find that comfortable. But much more than that, and you'll give them eye strain. At the other end of the scale is how close we want to push things, and you know, how much we want people's eyes to sort of go a little bit crossed. And the third thing, which is perhaps the most important, is where their eyes are going to, within those two limits, where their eyes are going to be converged on the subject. What's the position of the subject? What's the horizontal disparity? And I measure that as a percentage of the horizontal width of the screen. And that way I can sort of correlate it, or as the sort of screen size changes.
So if I was using an analogy with focus for a second, it's almost like with a single lens focus, it's almost like saying, well, we've got something that we've focused close, we've got something we've focused in the distance, we've got something we've focused close, and, you know, if the subject matter that the DOP has framed up is jumping around a lot, that's going to cause eye strain. Something that doesn't happen with the same artistic treatment with a sort of a flat 2D image. And so what you are doing is effectively using the dissolve kind of concept. We're actually sort of easing it out of one and easing it into the next so that we don't have hard cuts of jumps.
So I guess first we need to clarify two very different sort of concepts. One is parallax, which is dictated by the interaxial, the distance between the cameras. And the parallax is embedded in the image. There's nothing you can really do about that after the fact. You can sort of zoom in on the image, which will scale it all up proportionately. But whatever the distance is of the cameras between them when you photograph the scene is what your images are locked at. But what we can do in post, and what we will be doing a lot of, is the horizontal offset of the left and right images. And there's quite a number of parameters that we want to be considering when we do that. But so we can pan the left and right image. If we do it slowly, people won't even notice, because you don't judge distance by where your eyes happen to be converged or where they're focused. Your brain pretty much ignores that. It notices when it suddenly has to change, but you judge distance by sort of comparing the parallax information in the left and right image. So if we're looking at, say, shot A and we cut to shot B, and in shot A your screens are converged, your eyes are converged at a certain angle, if we can position the primary subject in shot B at exactly that sort of same position, so your eyes are converged at the same angle, we can do cuts, rapid cuts, no problem at all.
So let's just imagine we were filming a band for a second. We could be having the microphone or the stadium kind of thing happening and cutting around a lot, but we just don't want the eyes to have to do a lot of hard work. But as you said, it's funny because you imagine that your body is reading where the muscles are in terms of turning the eyes, that somehow I judge distance by how much those muscles have to turn the actual eyeball, but it isn't at all, is it really?
Yeah, from a study that I've read, a paper, there isn't very much in the way of the signals going back, you know, to the brain, to the visual system, that to keep track of, you know, which angle the eyes are pointing. You certainly notice when you have to change that. But yeah, like I said, but most of the hard work for the eyeballs is going to be with things up very close to the, you know, up close to the camera. So if we think about linear perspective, If you hold a pencil up to your face, very close, it's going to occupy like a horizontal field of view of like nearly 180 degrees. But if you move that away at a constant speed and plot the angular size of that pencil on a graph, you'll plot out an arctangent curve that will plummet down quite quickly and then plateau out.
So just to sort of simplify that concept, what I think you're saying is if it's close to your face, it's big and it gets smaller quickly, but then after a while it doesn't get smaller as fast as it was.
Yeah, it's so most of the 3D happens up close in front of the camera. So there's a number of sort of conclusions we can make from that and verify that by actually doing test shots. But if we, say, imagine a wireframe cube in our face, there's going to be a huge difference in the angular size of the near side of that cube compared to the far side. And that's what your brain is doing. This process of stereopsis, which is seeing 3D, is or sensing it, is comparing the linear perspective cues with the parallax cues. And both of those phenomena follow the arctangent curve.
Well, now, is there a chance that you may end up going into a consulting role? Because clearly you've done a huge amount of research on this, and I'm sure that a lot of companies would be keen to find out more.
Yeah, most definitely. The timing has worked out quite well. You mentioned earlier, it's about 3 years ago when I decided to go, almost 3 years ago, on this bit of a safari. But and in the process, pretty much made myself unemployable, because you do a test shoot and you photograph a bug or a flower or anything in 3D, and all the stuff I've ever done in the past on any movie I've ever worked on just doesn't compare. You know, it does not glue me to the screen as much as a good stereo photo. Yeah, and the audience reactions are just phenomenal too.
Yeah, no, they really are. They really are amazing images, and the breadth of stuff for a one-man operation, it's quite extraordinary. I'm sure there'll be a lot of people who are very interested. Can people actually go anywhere? You got a website that they can...
Yeah, I've got a very hokey website. It's almost embarrassing to mention it at the moment, so I'll have to polish it up a bit. But it's stereovfx.com, and I've got a few sample photos up there. But really, at the end of the day, I concluded early on that it's all about the presentation technology. Is you know, you can free view things on a computer screen to get a sense of what it should be looking for, but that's ultimately nothing like what it looks like on a cinema screen, where you don't have to do funky things with your eyes. You just pop a pair of effectively sunglasses on and everything else works for you. But field of view is the biggest variable in there, because the smaller the image, the smaller the field of view, the less depth you'll see in it. But, yeah, it does work off the websites, the samples I've put up there.
Look, thank you so much for taking time to talk to us. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, Mike.
And I'm definitely keen to see you work, say, with a natural documentary unit, because I think there could be some amazing stuff, and it must be tremendously exciting to be able to not only witness this stuff in person, as you said, on top of a mountain, but then actually be able to share that with other people and actually have them get some sense of that, some sense that they've previously not been able to, as to just the natural beauty of some of those locations.
Yeah, definitely. Thanks, Mike.
Thanks, Mike, and thanks, Tim. Well, that'll do it for this FX podcast. We're getting ready for NAB in April, where we'll be doing some FX Guide TV work, as well as our FX podcasts from Las Vegas. So for John Montgomery and Mike Seymour, I'm Jeff Huser. Thanks for listening.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by using the Contact Us links at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright 2008 FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.